Hello and welcome to The Future of Work and the Investment Landscape, the podcast that looks at all things work in the future, brought to you by Wenda for their blog Chaos and Rocket Fuel. Today, Wenda, CEO Claire Haydar and myself, Doug Folkes, are joined by Heyman Capital Management's founder and CIO, Kyle Bass. Hi, Kyle. How are you?
I'm great. Glad to be here.
Excellent. Kyle, thank you so much for taking time out of your very, very busy schedule to be here with us today. Digging right into things, Kyle, you know, whenever you and I have conversations that I always try to dig into the details because I'm just so fascinated with the work that you're doing. From my perspective, I consider you to be much more of an investigator rather than an investor. And the reason why I say that is because so much of your work involves tracing the money to unearth truths. How did you come to do what you do today?
Well, Claire, I'm excited to be here with you too. And the answer to that is a very long answer, but let's just say early on in my career, I really had a thing for investigative journalism. I wasn't one to just subscribe to newspapers, read the news, and move on. I'm very interested in long form, deep investigative journalism. And unearthing those truths and also bringing justice to the world and bringing those truths into the forefront. And as you know, in today's day and age, everything is so polarized and you must consider every source of every bit of data that you read. Things I used to trust almost completely, now my initial take is always to distrust everything I'm reading and figure out how to parse through, you know, truth from editorial slant. Early on, I started, trying to understand how, and this was more financially speaking, how special situations evolved. And what I mean by special situations are bankruptcies, spinoffs, frauds, corporate actions, mergers, things like that. And that's always been where I focused in my career from the moment I got out of undergrad.
Kyle, your work spans such a broad swath of major issues, everything from the opioid crisis through to the atrocities of the Chinese government and many other really, really serious global issues. Would you say that injustice is one of the core values that drives your work?
Whew, that is actually a really good question, Claire. I think that when you dedicate yourself to, let's just say following what gets our markets or individual companies into either difficult situations or great situations, and you try to peel back the layers of the onion that get it there. I've just been incredibly interested all along in the micro universe, i.e., company level, corporate company level data are things that I focused on early on in my career, and that was from 1992. Until 2007. And when you got to the global financial crisis, sovereigns had to back their banking systems, regardless of the fact that their banks were all insolvent. And it ended up breaking many of the sovereigns. If you remember, Iceland, Ireland, which Claire, you're very familiar with, Cyprus, Greece. What ended up happening in many of those places is when this financial crisis hit, they realized that their banking systems were much larger than their economic output and or macroprudentially, they weren't paying attention. And then when the banks collapsed, tracking those bad private assets to public balance sheets became somewhat of an obsession to me. And then that opened the world to this trying to understand the way the world's banking systems work. And when you try to understand the economics of the world, invariably it takes you to the politics and then then the injustices of the politics and the pros and cons of maybe Marxist-Leninist totalitarian communism versus good old-fashioned Western democracy. And that's where we stand today. But along the way, there have been many permutations of both. And the more time you spend understanding the plumbing of the systems, it takes you to what drives the plumbing and invariably it leads you to, call it a grand strategy of politics.
I just love what you've just said about, you know, peeling the onion back through those layers in terms of, you know, looking at the micro, which then leads you to that macro, which eventually ultimately leads you to the politics and then therefore the injustices of the politics. We're a company that's all about the future of work. And during this current global situation that we're facing, work is completely changing shape. And that's why I believe it's so important for leaders and executives who are navigating this landscape to start and basically follow that recipe that you've just laid out there, which is that look at the micro factors, you know, then move on to the macro and then look at the political landscape that underpins that. Because by understanding those three layers and the drivers within them, we will better be able to prepare ourselves for the future of work. So yeah, just really happy that's your thinking and that's what's coming out here, because that's exactly why, you know, your view on the future of work is so critical. Yeah.
Kyle, I'm going to jump in here and ask you to actually bring it down to the micro level, if you like. I mean, the future of work has taken a massive turn in the last few months. What do you think the landscape for an average employed person is going to look like in, say, the next 24 months through to, say, the next 5 years?
It is invariable that we will see, I believe, permanent reductions in headcount, number one. I think that this the Wuhan virus has basically been a polarizing force on the leadership and the rank and file employees of many organizations. Those of us that run organizations have realized that it's been a forced realization of who the superstars are and then who the people in your organization are that actually you can easily do without. And I know that sounds particularly harsh, but I can tell you that that's true across the board. So there'll be a certain amount of people that are unemployed today that will be rehired at their, call it, current rate of salary and benefits. I think that'll probably end up being about 40% of the people that are unemployed will be hired without any blood or change. I think then you're going to see maybe another 30% that will be called recalled at a reduced rate of benefits and salary. And then I actually think there's going to be, unfortunately, there's going to be a permanently either unemployed or sector of the workforce that are going to have to be retrained into becoming more productive. So I think that this crisis is going to bring change within organizations that way, and then external to the organization itself, I think it's going to change the manner in which some commercial real estate is valued. I would not want to be the owner of office buildings based upon cap rates from 2019 coming into 2020, because I think, I don't know about you guys, but I think you will see more people working from home. I think you're going to see valuations of various real estate assets change pretty dramatically over the next, call it, 2 or 3 years.
Kyle, you've stated something very interesting there, which I'd like to segue to, which is you've broken it down to where you believe, you know, that about 40% of the unemployed population right now will be rehired at the current rate. There's going to be the 30% that will be rehired at a reduced rate, and then that remaining 30% will most likely have to be retrained. That has a significant impact on any organization. Particularly, I'm focusing in on that retrained piece, that 30% retrained piece there. Talk to me a little bit more around what do you think are going to be the significant areas where that retraining needs to happen?
I believe that it's really tough to teach an old dog a new trick. And when I say that, I think these retraining programs, and what I mean by that is people that have jobs that are either going to be automated out or are no longer needed given the dynamism of the workforce and the manner in which people have adapted to work on, let's say, Slack or some other messaging system like Slack. I think there are going to be much, much fewer executive assistants and receptionists. And I think those people are going to have to learn how to do something that is vitally important to these organizations, i.e. whether it's code, whether it's get into legal and compliance, whether it's through education or professional training. I think people are going to have to learn how to adapt and kind of move up the ladder. What we've learned is there is a way to really reduce and eliminate positions that otherwise have been around for the last, 30, 40 years.
The other thing that this opens up is the divide of income. The popular opinion on the streets is that the income divide is growing. I'd like to hear from you, based on the numbers that you track so closely, what is the data really telling us?
I actually think the more important and the more divisive issue is the wealth gap. It's so much different than the income gap. And so I actually think the central bank's policy is the key agitant or friction creator for all of the inequities that you see in the world today and all of the protests. When you see central banks try to eliminate business cycles, how many rich people do you know that were less rich than they are today in 2006 at the top of the market, right? Before the 2008 financial crisis? What central banks have done, taking rates to zero and expanding their balance sheets into the trillions across the G7, has created this giant. It's just expanded the wealth gap. The haves have so much more because they're levered to all of these assets. The have-nots continue to have not. And the middle class actually has less upward mobility because they can't afford homes because median income is not moving as fast as home prices. And so I think you see the unrest in Hong Kong, the unrest that you're seeing across the U.S., they like to call it, I don't think it's that racial. I actually think it's a difference in wealth.
This is such a critical core concept for people to really understand, because it is directly linked to work and how people should be thinking about their employment. If you were to break what you've just explained down to us as if you were explaining it to a five-year-old, could you do that?
You would just say that the Wizard of Oz, that happens to be running the biggest bank in the country, makes sure that most businesses stay open and that people have access to borrowing money, whenever they want. And the price of everything is going up very quickly. And your income is not, the money you bring home is not going up that much. So, as each year goes by, we're going to have to, have fewer nicer things, and mom and dad are going to have to work a lot harder. It's a tough subject to boil down to a five-year-old, because, central banking is something that's it's a concept that's hard to explain to a 25-year-old that's not well-versed in economics.
I like your Wizard of Oz explanation, because it is simple enough to understand this is the broken piece. And ultimately, the problem that you're describing here is not something that an individual can actually control.
It penalizes savers, right? Because they take interest rates to zero and negative. It penalizes people that have worked their whole lives and are expecting their companies to provide them their pension to retire on. And it affects people that already have savings in the bank, because as we all know, if you're getting no return on your savings, but the price of hamburgers and hot dogs and steaks and barbecue and anything you consume, movies. I mean, just think about when you go to restaurants and you go to movies. I remember when spending $100 for a dinner for two at a restaurant was like your anniversary dinner once a year.
Yeah.
And you went back to eating peanut butter and jelly the next day to save up. And today, a dinner for two at a decent restaurant is $100. I think every single person listening understands that, like, what's the price of a new car, Claire? Have you ever seen the price of a new car that you like go down over time?
Never. No. Yeah.
Right. And this is the insidious nature, because, by the way, the government prints these things. So we went back and we looked at 30 years of how the U.S. government calculates the consumer price index. And we looked at the auto component very specifically. Mm-hmm. And when you look, call it 30 years ago, the average car price in the U.S. was around $13,500. When you look at today, the average car price of a new car today is somewhere around $42,000 or $41,000. So you're talking about a tripling of the average car price in a 30-year period. If car prices have more than tripled in 30 years, How much of that do you think made it in over a 30-year period into the consumer price index? 6 or 7% made it in out of 300. Do you know why? Because they do this thing called chain wheeling. So they'll take the car today at 42,000, and the government will say, well, you know, you have electric windows. The car 30 years ago had roll down windows. So if you take out, if we need to compare apples to apples, you're going to have to remove the cost and the equipment for the electric windows. And then you say, wow, you have this heads up display, you have all of this functionality in your dashboard. Well, back then it was an analog dashboard. So if you were to put in an analog dashboard, what would it cost today? And so they literally take apart the car virtually, and they say, well, if it was just a car, just like it was back then it's only 6% more expensive. But in reality, when you get your checkbook out, you don't have those options. The chain-weighted concept allows the government to actually not record inflation. And why that's important to the government is many of the government's adjustments, you probably heard of this concept of COLA, cost of living adjustments. Mm-hmm. Many of the government payments that they owe people have COLA adjustments in them that are indexed to the government's determination of inflation. So what I'm telling you is the inmate is actually running the asylum. If you look at the CPI, there's one big deflationary component where they actually record significant price declines. Mm-hmm. And it's in the price and cost of data.
Carla, I'd just like to bring it back to work again. You mentioned it a little bit earlier about remote work. It's definitely the new thing. From your lens, what are the top five precautions and considerations that senior leaders in organizations should be thinking about?
I'm a poor leader of large organizations. I have a small organization, and I'm much better at that. But one of the concepts that I've discussed with my contemporaries, that some who run much larger organizations, for anyone that says people that work at home are more productive than someone that works at an office, I think that is a fallacy. You and I both know that, or the three of us know that anyone working at home has many more distractions than they have at work. If you were to think about the efficient frontier, 100% being someone that's 100% productive at work minus, you know, a 30-minute break here and a 40-minute lunch break or whatever, where they have a scheduled time off during the day. It's my view that people that prior to the Wuhan virus, I would say people were probably at work even on average, were probably 60 to 70% productive. The friction at home is probably gone from 30 to 40 to 50 to 60. And so that's materially worse. So when I think about how do we combat that, there are a lot of tech gadgets out there that enable Orwellian tech gadgets out there that will allow employers to make sure their employees are productive, working hard, and paying attention. And so whether that's facial recognition cameras and keyboards that need to stay active and phones, monitoring, I know that all sounds terrible to all of us, but if we're going into this mode working at home, you need to have someone overseeing both quality and quantity control of your workers. And I think those are the things that, as we take that kind of large step, I think that those kinds of Orwellian things that are required to monitor folks are going to have to be put in place.
Kyle, is this a personal opinion that you have, or do you have actual data sets that you're looking at that backs up what you're saying?
You know, this is not my area of expertise at all. This is in talking with people that run firms that have, 10 to 500 people. So those are actually considered small firms. So I'm not even talking about, Fortune 500 or Fortune 1000 based companies. But everyone's trying, all of the business leadership is trying to grapple with this call it question/problem. In my case, I spend almost all of my time, dealing with the investments and moving the firm forward from the investing perspective. So, I'm giving you the just pure opinion and
pure
nothing
opinion,
backing
yeah.
it up from a data perspective.
The interesting thing, to comment on what you said there, this is actually an area where I would, disagree with you on based on our own experience of running a virtual company, but coming back to the point that you made about the fact that organizations are really going to be grappling with who their superstar employees are. I think that's where we're going to see this interesting mix start coming to the fore. Yeah, where we're going to grapple with these type of concepts is, I think that we can't just make a blanket statement across organizations to say that the numbers that you've hypothesized about apply across the org. I think, you know, like you see in most things in life, there's a distribution where you've got your outlier performers. And I think that's where, you know, organizations are really going to start focusing, because I think the productivity numbers from those superstar employees are going to look very different to the rest of the data set.
I actually might agree with you that when you talk about the high functioning employees that you have and partners that you have, I think we can all turn off the world and focus on our work and what we need to focus on. The highest skilled and the people that are running firms, I don't think you're going to see any loss of productivity whatsoever. But I do think you'll see it. You'll see it in the middle of the organization.
Coming back to that political level, I think we've looked at the micro, we've dug into that piece, we've definitely looked at some of the macro components. If we can move on to that political piece of the onion that we're peeling back, what are some of the legislative reforms that you suggest, you know, countries should be looking at and seriously considering given this big, big disruption that we're currently living through?
When I think about, my area of expertise is at the time, I call it in the last 8 or 9 years, has been the U.S.-China relationship, the U.S.-Hong Kong relationship, the China-Hong Kong relationship. And so, you know, we're talking about a period of time in which all of those relationships are at, call it their most severe, they're in the most severe flux that they've been in the last, 40 years. When you ask legislative reforms, I'll take you a step back and just say, because you have this fundamental forces acting against one another, you have fundamentally incompatible political systems. Mm. You have a totalitarian Marxist-Leninist communism with Chinese characteristics, and then you have Western democracy. One doesn't care about human rights whatsoever. In fact, they will trample human rights to achieve the goals of the state. And the other has a fundamental basis in a Bill of Rights and inalienable rights that each individual citizen in the United States and Europe and, must have as a fundamental basic right of life. And those systems, in my view, are completely incompatible. And yet we've been trying to trade where fundamentally, from a systemic perspective, there is no common ground. There is no agreement on what's right and wrong. From my perspective, when we think about legislating things, the simple basic legislation that's got to be pushed through, and again, in financial markets, is we've got to level the playing field. Right now, Chinese companies in the United States don't have to adhere to the exact same securities laws as U.S. companies do. They get a pass. We gave them a pass in 2013. I think we need to level the playing field from the perspective of corporate interests. But that goes another step further, Claire. Why on earth do Western democracies interface with a villain like China, who has between 1 and 3 million people in concentration camps, simply because of their religious preference? I thought our world said never again after World War II. It's absolutely insane that we're entering into, that Wall Street continues to invest in countries like this by turning a blind eye to human rights abuses. That in itself is a big head scratcher for me. So when I think about policy, I think we need to completely rewrite policy and require our trading partners to adhere to some sort of a basic norm of human rights, of climate. We continue to interface with some of the worst climate offenders on the planet today. And it's in the interest of trying to just earn another buck or another shekel.
And this is where that interplay between the micro and the macro and the political becomes so important again, because the whole culture that we try and breed in Western democracies, not only the US but other democracies, is, you know, basic principles of, if you're in a relationship with somebody, there has to be some shared value set. If you're, you know, hiring people into a company, there needs to be some type of culture fit. You know, those are the things that we're spousing at the micro level, yet we're not doing it at the macro in many cases, and at the political level, as you say.
No, and it's almost taboo to talk about. You've seen the narrative change because the communists are playing their hands so poorly. They're playing such a heavy hand, whether it's North Korea literally blowing up the relations center between North Korea and South Korea just a couple of days ago, or whether it's China abrogating a deal that they signed in 1984 with Great Britain, in 1992 with the US, and the 1984 agreements filed and ratified at the UN. And yet China just says, you know what? It's actually not useful for them anymore. So they're just going to come over the top of Hong Kong. That kind of abrogation of international agreements, international responsibilities for that matter, is going to forever change the governance and the relationship between our two countries, and really Western democracy. Those countries' relationships with the totalitarian systems of, let's call it, Russia or Venezuela or China or Cuba, I think those relationships are going to be rewritten over the next few years. And I think that will happen regardless of political leadership in the US or Europe. I think the pattern and the path is set. Because we all, I think you put it perfectly, Claire, you have to have a shared value set. And, you know, that shared value set can't be money and profits at the cost of everything else. I think we need to bring morality back into the equation.
Carl, we're actually coming towards the end of our time together. And just listening to you there, I mean, legislation is obviously something you could talk about passionately for many more hours, I'm sure. I'd just like to bring things just back down for my last question, which is just around the macro level again. What do you think society's blind spots are when we're considering the future of work?
When I think about the biggest blind spot that the world has, it's simply greed. And it's allowing greed to supersede any of the rest of your own value system.
Kyle, to wrap up our session today, as you know, I can keep talking for hours and hours on so many of these topics with you, but to bring things to an end, you're a deep thinker, you're a prolific reader, and as I learned today, which I didn't know before, is that you truly have a passion for investigative journalism, which very much makes total sense because of your curious mind. What would you say people should be paying attention to right now? And are there specific sources that you could recommend to everybody listening in?
I don't read the newspaper every day. I don't have any particular routine. What I found, and maybe to my wife's chagrin, about 2 or 3 years ago, I actually found Twitter. And with Twitter, I've learned throughout my years that I trust very specific people. And whether they're journalists, academics, politicians, there are some people I trust. And then if you look at who I follow, you know, look, I follow President Trump. That's not because I fully trust him or that I voted for him. It's simply because I also need to see some of the propaganda and rhetoric that's out there. I follow the Chinese propaganda outlets because they're the official mouthpieces of the CCP. So I still follow people that are playing games, but I also follow very specific people that I have a lot of trust and faith in. And so I think Twitter is kind of a newspaper or TV for intellectuals. I don't use it for leisure at all. I use it for kind of create an information funnel that I use that comes to me, that is the way I want to see it and read it. And so when I think about what some of the best books are out there today, they're books that I'm very interested in. The 100-Year Marathon by Michael Pillsbury. Now, I think Michael Pillsbury is actually a double agent and working for the Chinese government, but he wrote a really good piece on the history of the relationship.
Kyle, final question, just based on something you said. You said that you follow very specific people that you trust. Could you give us a framework in terms of how you define trust and how you recognize it in somebody?
You know, I have a lot of friends in various places, again, whether they're academics, think tanks, or in the government. You know, if I interface with them on a personal basis like you, and I say, Claire, you know, who do you think the best person in a specific technology is, or someone that writes about it, I bet right off the top of your head, you would know one or two names. You know, it's just like that.
Kyle, thank you so much for your time today. It's been really, really good to have this hour-long conversation with you. Thank you for taking time out.
Thank you, Claire. Thanks, Doug. And I look forward to talking with you guys in the future.
Our time is up, Kyle. Thank you for your time and global insights to the future of work. Claire, again, thank you for being here, for setting everything up. From us at Chaos and Rocket Fuel, thanks for listening. Keep safe and be sure to pop back soon.